have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Welcome to Gay USA. I'm Andy Hum.
And I'm Ann Northrup, celebrating the victory of the Boston Red Sox last night against the hated New York Yankees.
They got a lot of parts here in town.
It's a brief triumph because we're about to go up against the inevitable Tampa Bay Rays. So I'm just taking my comfort where I can.
All right, before we get to the news, our guest at the top of the show is Bennett Singer, co-director with Patrick Salmon of the documentary Cured, about how early gay and lesbian activists and mental health professionals got the American Psychiatric Association to drop homosexuality from its index of mental disorders in 1973. Just a few years after Stonewall. It was a monumental victory. Cured is going to play on PBS on October 11th. In most areas, National Coming Out Day.
So we're going to talk to Bennett shortly, and then we'll get into our regular news broadcast, which will include a discussion of mass demonstrations from coast to coast demanding protection of the constitutional right to abortion.
A Big Ten marching band came out for LGBTQ pride at halftime.
It was pretty stirring. High school students in Texas stood up for their transgender classmate. And these revolutions are taking place in schools around the country. We'll talk about a couple others.
Right. The Stonewall National Monument in Greenwich Village is going to get a permanent pole for pride flags.
We have a lot of people to celebrate this week. We're going to mourn a Disney teen film star who was fired by Disney for being gay in the 1960s. The only out lesbian to have served in the Israeli Knesset, a leading transgender activist in North Carolina, a behind-the-scenes AIDS advocate who saved thousands of lives securing access to HIV drugs through the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, and yet another young black trans woman shot to death in Dallas.
And the anti-LGBTQ governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, was caught up in a heterosexual and nepotism scandal.
We like to keep track of what's going on with the heterosexuals.
So Cured is going to be on PBS October 11th, Independent Lens, 10 p.m. Check your local listings. Let's bring on our guest. Hi, Bennett.
Hello, hello. Wonderful to be here. It's great to see you.
Bennett Singer is the co-director of the film with Patrick Salmon. This film is a brisk 58-minute trip through a monumental campaign. We should point out that you were also the director of Brother Outsider about Bayard Rustin. The Obamas are now making a dramatic film about him. But anyway, here you are.
Co-director, I should say. But I love
that as well.
Yes.
When I started coming out in the late 60s, I was still sick. By 1973, I was cured. Who was this band of heroes who mounted this campaign?
Well, yeah, it was quite an unlikely campaign in the sense that as of the late 60s and early 70s, there was this pervasive. Sexuality was indeed a mental disorder. It was classified as a sociopathic personality disturbance, to use the technical term. And if you were gay or lesbian, as of, you know, according to the DSM, you were automatically this classified as a sociopath. And that was based on this notion of a failure to conform to accepted norms. That's what triggered that or underlay that diagnosis. And people, beginning with Frank Kameny, I think he deserves the initial credit for seeing that this was a incredible impediment to any hope of progress for gay people. Kameny, in the mid-60s, declared war on the psychiatric establishment, and then he brought together allies among the activists, including Barbara Giddings and her life partner, Kayla Houston, who's in this photo behind me, marching there in 1968. And then they broadened the team, as it were, to include psychiatrists, to include straight allies, to include gay liberation activists across the country. And that's part of what's fascinating about the story. It wasn't exactly a systematic form of activism with a clear flow chart and a set of actions, you know, mandated from the top. There was a series of spontaneous zaps and protests, which evolved into dialogue and a whole process within the APA, taking stock of its own system for classifying what does and does not constitute a mental illness. And that question was really at the heart of what this story is about.
I was impressed by the fact that it was a sort of semi-rational debate within the APA, that they didn't just freak out and arrest everybody. They had an actual discussion back and forth about whether classifying homosexuality as a mental illness was appropriate.
That's such a good point. And I think, yeah, there was this turning point in the activism where the early protests really involved confrontations and invasions and shutting down meetings and yelling and really making the point that we're gay and, you know, we don't want to be brutalized. And that was
just like ACT UP. It was so reminiscent
absolutely.
Of ACT UP.
Absolutely.
You know, we're the experts. Talk to us.
When you grabbed a microphone in those days, that it caught them off guard. I mean, they didn't quite know what to do.
Right. But then in that scene, and, you know, miraculously enough, there is footage of a zap where the activists do indeed literally grab the microphone. But then what's fascinating about that, and that's footage from a 1970 protest in Los Angeles, instead of shutting it down and saying, we're done, the activists said, we want to talk to you. And this has been a monologue, and let's make it a dialogue. And in the footage, you see them breaking down into small groups where the gay and lesbian activists are actually sitting down with the therapists and saying, you know, you're talking so much about us, but let's talk to each other. And that was, I think, an incredibly important turning point in this larger movement where the psychiatrists and psychologists for the first time realized, well, these people don't seem to be sick. They claim that they're happy, that they're well-adjusted, that they're functioning, you know, productively in society. And why are we branding them as sick and saying that they, you know, are, as Charles Socarides, one of the main proponents of this label, he would say, well, there's no hope of happiness or a well-adjusted behavior or, you know, or happy relationships. And the activists were really challenging that head on.
Well, because the people who came to them for help were unhappy about being gay. This might be a good time to show the trailer, Anne, you think? Yes.
I was just going to suggest that. Instead of talking about the film, let's show some of the film.
I love the way you think. Yes, brilliant.
If you were gay in those days, you were diagnosed as suffering from a mental disorder. Like so many people in my generation, I went to psychoanalysis to be cured.
These are some of the methods doctors employ to cure homosexuality. Electroshock therapy, hysterectomies on lesbians, castrations of gay men.
People use psychiatry as a reason to discriminate. Apart from the discrimination against us, it gave us a horrible image of ourselves.
In the early 1970s, there was this growing rebellion against psychiatry, and we wanted to remove homosexuality from the diagnostic and statistical manual.
The body of knowledge which claims sickness for homosexuality has to be challenged.
We could not expect our civil rights as long as we were burdened with the sickness label.
Maybe it makes you feel good to be able to say that we are sick. Does it make you feel good?
The body of medical evidence suggests that it is a mental aberration.
There were so many of us that were at the same point. Enough is enough. We're not going to take it anymore. Period.
A number of psychiatrists talked about, why don't we organize? We can make an impact. John Fryer took a step as being the first psychiatrist to say, I'm a gay person. But no one recognized him. He represented all the people who were hiding and invisible. The effect was electric.
At psychiatric annual meetings, there were demonstrations, if not, in fact, riots. Ron Gold is a gay activist. He got up there and he yelled out,
Stop it, you're making me sick.
I told them in my speech, you don't have the right to decide that perfectly happy people are sick.
This fight was the most important moment in gay liberation history.
Less people think this is going to go in far away. I'm turning 68 this month, and so when I started practicing homosexuality, I was sick. But you, once I did it, you couldn't tell me there was anything wrong with it, including the Catholic Church, which I was still in. You couldn't tell me it was wrong. But obviously a lot of people were damaged. I mean, with such brutal treatments. I just want to say, I had a friend my age who was lobotomized in Kings County Hospital, a teenager, for being gay. And he became an activist, but he was lobotomized.
Yeah, I think that's really important to remember. These weren't just, 81 words in a dusty manual sitting on a shelf. This was a diagnosis that had life and death consequences for people, sometimes in the form of the treatments that you're mentioning, Andy, like lobotomies and electroshock therapy. Other times, as with one of our storytellers in the film, Charles Silverstein, he went to talk therapy 3 times a week for 7 years, which is another form of brutality. And then Reverend Magora Kennedy, also in the film, was forced to get married at the age of 14 instead of going to a mental institution, which was the other option her mother kindly gave her. And so there's so many different aspects of violations of human rights that stem directly from that diagnosis.
And it's quite a claim that this is the most important turning point in the movement for LGBTQ rights or dignity or freedom. But as I thought about that, I thought that was a pretty legitimate claim.
I agree. It's pretty thought-provoking or provocative. And, that was Charles Silverstein's assertion. And we thought about, should we pull back on that? But I do think there's an argument to be made that this was the first domino to fall on the road to not only equality, but also on the road to fuller acceptance of ourselves.
Well, we still haven't won the fight with most major religions who classify us.
Very true.
We still haven't won the fight with the federal government who refused to pass the Equality Act. So that
same. And even more directly related, efforts to cure or convert people are continuing through conversion therapy. Yeah. So the battle absolutely continues. But, on the conversion therapy front, what's fascinating is that now every major medical institution, including the APA, is on the side of gay people, saying that efforts to change or convert people are harmful and destructive and need to be ended.
Although it took the American Psychoanalytic Association until the early 90s to do it.
That's very true. Slowly, better late than never.
And the right wing is still arguing that these institutional changes are the result of political pressure and not a sincere change.
I know. And that's another theme that we look at in the film. Was it politics or was it science that really motivated the APA to make this change? And I would argue that, of course, there were political elements to this battle, but at the heart of the argument that the activists were making was an argument about science versus prejudice.
My friend George Weinberg, who wrote Society and the Healthy Homosexual in 1972, he was a psychoanalyst, he said, my colleagues are still anti-gay, but they had to go along because of the culture and all that. Look, the vote, they put, I don't want to give everything away in the film, but they had to put this to a vote. And
yes,
our side got 58%. It goes by fast, but I want to say this for our viewers. What they were asked to affirm was getting rid of homosexuality from the index of mental disorders and substituting sexual orientation disturbance, which was sort of a way for them to say, if you were still unhappy about this, and you could still come to a psychiatrist for help.
Right. That was a short-lived sort of stopgap measure. But the activists led by Ron Gold at that point and Kameny really declared victory. And they said, you know, homosexuality per se was indeed removed from the DSM. This is a sea change. We're going to declare victory. And the other nuances really did sort of fade away quite quickly. And as of 1973, this mental illness label was, for all intents and purposes, lifted.
The other thing that still goes on, of course, are things like police entrapment and continuing arrests and exposure, publication of people's names in newspapers if they are subject to those arrests. We have a lot of work to do. I think watching this documentary is fundamentally important to understand these issues and where we've been and how far we've come and how far we haven't come.
I it's great to hear your take. And I would just add, it's, you know, the stars have sort of aligned that the broadcast is happening on National Coming Out Day, October 11th, Independent Lens, the series that has acquired the film, happens to have a Monday night slot, and October 11th happens to be a Monday. But it's really a chance to think about coming out for all of us. And, you know, there's that scene in the film where Dr. John Fryer came out to his psychiatrist colleagues. But in order to open up and really reveal who he was, he had to put on this distorted mask and hide behind a mask to make the point that he was, in fact, a healthy gay psychiatrist. But if he had done it openly, he would have lost his medical license, most likely, and would have been fired. So I think that ongoing lesson and reminder that coming out is a form of activism is another takeaway from the film.
And there's also the poignant story of Richard Socarides, out gay man and activist, coming out to his homophobic, horribly destructive father, Charles Socarides, who was the leader of the anti-LGBT faction.
Absolutely. And Richard did agree to be interviewed for the film, which was a rare event. And he does open up in some very moving ways, talking about his relationship with his father, and even talks about, you know, his father would be downstairs in the first floor of their townhouse attempting to cure gay patients, while Richard himself was upstairs experimenting and learning what it was like to be a young homosexual. So
and Charles never gave up. He fought a rear guard action till the day he died, not so long ago.
Yes.
I remember in 1976, the Gay Activist Alliance, we zapped Socarides, Bieber, Uribe. They were trying to speak. They had 300 psychiatrists in New York in a room to talk about this. So we all stood up and said, you're not talking about this without us. 76, 3 years later. Hmm. And they just called off the meeting. They would not let us join the panel.
Hmm.
And he kept this up in spite of knowing his gay son, who he seemed to have a loving relationship with, but somehow there was this inability to cross that barrier.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of stories in the film about parents and children, I'll say, including the Socarides father-son dynamic, but also Charles Silverstein and his mother, and Magora Kennedy and her mother. And that's a big theme that happens to be threaded through the stories.
Well, they were making a lot of money off us with these, you know, three times a week, five times a week.
Absolutely.
Larry Kramer did it. I mean, Martin Duberman did it. So many people went to these psychiatrists and they were, you know, making them a lot of money because we couldn't be cured.
Absolutely.
But some of that was forced. Larry at Yale told its gay students that they had to go for this kind of therapy or they couldn't remain at the school. So there was a large collaboration of a lot of institutions. To some extent, I'm surprised because Freud declared homosexuality not a mental illness in the 1930s. So I'm trying to figure out where this all came from in the midst of that. But I'm not sure we have those answers.
Well, part of the story, I think, is that, you know, after World War II, this renewed push for conformity and sort of the idea that we need to be normal and regimented, you know, on the security level, and you know what that meant was various forms of deviance, including homosexuality, were really considered taboo and a subversive and a threat to the security of this country. That was
a threat to reproduction as a mandate.
And you put all this in the context of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the women's movement.
Right. I think there was that interplay going on, the sense of liberation and freedom and people finding their voices and finding community and really
standing up to authority.
Absolutely.
And the need for collaboration among those movements to make progress and be successful. Well, if we go on much longer, we'll have told the entire film. So let's leave a little mystery and remind people Monday, October 11th, 10 p.m. on PBS in New York, but check your local listings for Independent Lens and the movie Cured. Bennett Singer, co-director of the movie. It really is a magnificent achievement.
We're giving it 2 thumbs up, 5 stars from Gay USA.
Yeah.
That means a lot to me. It's such a great pleasure to connect with you both and to know that you're still fighting the good fight through your work on this broadcast. It's fantastic.
We've outlived Charles Socarides.
Although he has a young son named Charles Socarides, who's a pretty good actor.
That's true, too. Yes.
All right. Okay. For next time. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Bennett.
And Bennett.
Watch
on Monday.
Yeah. And congratulations. We'll
Thanks
see you
a million.
Soon.
See you soon.
Bye. Well,
it really is a terrific film. You will be doing yourself a favor by watching it.
It's
only an hour. So Cured on PBS October 11th.
Just like Gay USA. So this week were the National Marches for Reproductive Rights. The big one was in Washington. We have a picture there. I went to the one in New York and saw this young woman standing there looking, you know, alarmed, because we ought to be alarmed as the Supreme Court threatens on they're going to hear a case on December 1st to uphold the Mississippi law, which bans abortion after 15 weeks. Roe v. Wade guarantees it to viability, which is about 26 weeks. So I will say I was disappointed that about 80% of the crowd was women, and there should have been a lot more men out there fighting for this.
The Texas case, which the Supreme Court refused to stop the implementation of the law currently, but the challenge to the law is now in front of a federal judge in Texas who is a gay Obama appointee, Robert Pittman.
Who was also supported by the Republican Texas senators for his appointment.
Well, I'm hopeful that we'll get a good decision out of him, but of course, that's just preliminary. The right wing will continue to appeal any decision back to the Supreme Court. And
well, the court is losing its legitimacy, and they know it. That's why they're speaking out, saying we are legitimate.
Well, they may lose their legitimacy, but they still have their power. So,
And Biden's nominees to the court are being slowed down by Ted Cruz in the Senate. But Biden is also way behind on making nominations. Get with the program.
He's got a lot to do.
Let somebody else do it.
That's why you have a staff. Yes. Speaking of which, Stephanie Grisham, a Trump staffer, her new book is out. And one of the little tidbits in it is that Melania had a gay staffer who got fired when the White House realized that he was on Grindr. Evidently, that's a firing offense in the Trump administration.
And Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, was asked if he supported same-sex marriage this week. And he said it's the law of the land. And he would not say if he supported the law of the land.
We know
that they are lawless. But he said it's what America holds. He's a staunch opponent of LGBTQ rights.
All right. Well, let's go to the Midwest for a few stories. First of all, some good news in Michigan at the University of Michigan latest football game. These marching bands are a big deal at all these football games, these college football games. And the University of Michigan marching band this week celebrated their LGBTQ campus center, the Spectrum Center. They ended up with this on the field with the band and the formation Love Wins, which I guess has become our one of our slogans.
It took 8 months to plan this thing. And they did songs from Lady Gaga, Madonna, Cyndi Lauper, Sister Sledge, Kim Petras, Whitney Houston, Diana Ross, and the theme song from Golden Girls.
Well, what I like is the stands are full there, and we're going to play you the first 20 or 30 seconds of that event to let you hear the stadium announcer explain what's about to happen.
Today, the Michigan Marching Band and Alumni Band celebrate the 50th anniversary of the university's Spectrum Center, a collaborative space of advocacy, allyhood, education, and support for the LGBTQ plus campus community, beginning with the medley of I'm Coming Out and Born This Way.
Sting.
These are the moments when I say that we have won and we can now retire when the University of Michigan marching band is.
We're also getting a lot of support from high school students at Temple High School in Texas. Dozens walked out after a trans student, Kendall Tinoco, 16, was told she couldn't use the women's locker room after doing so last year without incident. The school's guidelines require dead naming trans students unless they get a legal name change, must dress in gender normative ways, and insist on a separate gender neutral restroom for them.
Where else?
Missouri?
In Kansas City, Missouri, at Lee Summit High School, it turns out that a gay senior, Denny Lillis, has been tortured by bullies for several years. They scream epithets at him. And finally, one of his friends got sick of it. And when the bullies attacked, she spoke up. All she did was speak up. And she got in a confrontation with the bullies who came after her, and one of them just slugged her and broke her nose. She and me and another friend and the bullies were suspended. All of them were suspended. The students are so angry about Denny and the girl and the other one being suspended that they staged a walkout of their school.
This seems.
Yeah, it's a growing movement that these kids say, we're not going to take this, and they walk out.
And let's go to Vanderbilt University in Nashville. It's being sued by a longtime trans employee, Olivia Hill, we have a picture of her, after she was ridiculed and abused following her transition. She worked at the university's power plant for 25 years. Her lawyer is Abby Rubenfeld, a former head of Lambda Legal.
Who, and sister of Pee Wee Herman.
Yes, indeed. Who charges the school with violating its own anti-discrimination policies relative to LGBTQ people. The university says it's taking steps to help our employees feel respected, included, and safe. Well, get on it.
Olivia was forced into an involuntary leave while everyone who was harassing her went unpunished.
Outrageous. Well, all right. A more positive story from New York City. The Stonewall National Monument in Greenwich Village is getting a flagpole for rainbow flags. The current pole, which does have a rainbow flag on it, is on state property just outside the monument. Trump would not allow it on the grounds of the Stonewall Monument, the federal monument. Biden administration will. The Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, is authorizing this. She has a non-binary child herself. The advocacy work of Michael Petrelis of San Francisco had a lot to do with this. And they're gonna raise a variety of pride flags.
And in ancillary political news from South Dakota, Governor Kristi Noem, you want to talk about what's happened to her?
Well, she had to jettison, you've read about Corey Lewandowski as an advisor, as she looks to run for president, because Corey was credibly accused of openly sexually harassing a female Trump donor, Trashel Odom, her name was. Noam called Corey, oh, he's just a volunteer. But a conservative website called AM Greatness claimed the two were having an extramarital affair, Corey and the governor, to which Noam, a gay-hating, COVID-denying, radical right-winger, responded, these rumors are total garbage and disgusting lies. I love my husband. I'm proud of the God-fearing family we've raised together. She's also corrupt, getting her daughter's license as a real estate appraiser approved after it was denied, then forcing the woman who denied it to retire. So while she insists she did not have sex with that man, Mr. Lewandowski, maybe she was just saying that having sex with him was disgusting, which it would be. Working with him is disgusting enough. She calls it an attack on conservative women, but it was a multi-sourced report.
We're currently watching the HBO documentary series Nuclear Family, three-parter. Part two aired this Sunday. It's getting very intense.
I'm starting to feel a little more sympathetic towards the lesbian side.
Yes, the bio father, it turns out to be quite aggressive in unappealing ways about suing them. So I continue to recommend the series, which you can certainly catch up on demand or on HBO Max, Nuclear Family. But there's a current case that we're now hearing about in Nebraska where two moms, a lesbian couple there in the background, had each carried a child, their two sons there, and then they separated. And before they got married.
Before they could get married.
Yes, before they could get married. And now they're trying to both be recognized as both parents of each son, but they're being forbidden to do that by the state that says, well, you're not married. You have to get married. No, we separated. Don't you get it?
But so the ACLU is taking up the case, and it's interesting because a man can just say, I accept paternity for this child,
right,
and they will make him the father.
Yep.
That just signs a statement. But they're not doing that for them. They said, well, we'll give you the temporary status of in loco parentis, but that is just temporary. So Lambda is suing. They're concerned, like if one of them died, the non-biological parent would have no rights. The non-biological son could be taxed on inheritance, etc. So they want equal rights.
This all goes back to ancient times when paternity was assumed by for a male partner because they wanted to preserve inheritance rights and they didn't want to challenge the paternity of the existent male partner on the grounds that that would be too upsetting to suggest that maybe the child had a different father. So that system evolved, but it doesn't do any good for a female couple.
So speaking of abortion, I like the bill that was introduced in Illinois. It would allow anyone except a state official to sue a person who causes unintended pregnancy or who commits domestic assault. Half the money will go to a fund for people from Texas to get abortions in Illinois.
Well, I like the fact that Pat Robertson is retiring from the 700 Club.
Unless
his son is taking over.
Unless God gives him a revelation, he will come back to convey it.
He's 91. He created the Christian Broadcasting Network in 1966, 55 years ago. He off the fortune he got from a blood diamond mine in Africa. He, of course, was a presidential candidate and just a troublemaker all around who has blamed us for everything bad that has ever happened in the world. He says, you know, we're fomenting a lesbian Marxist revolution, to which I say, if only.
Yes.
You know, he's against Black Lives Matter and everything else. But he is finally going to disappear from his daily appearances on the TV screen. But yeah.
Junior is taking over.
Yeah. I'm sure he's not an improvement. If we look at Franklin Graham and his son, it can only get worse.
Well, let's talk about some people we've lost in the past week.
Yeah.
Tommy Kirk. Remember him? Child star.
Remember him? Old Yeller was the first movie I went to see at a movie theater.
Right. That was his big hit. But he also did Swiss Family Robinson, The Shaggy Dog, Son of Flubber. He's died at 79. He was let go by Disney at 21 when he was caught fooling around with a 15-year-old at a pool.
Whose mother turned him in to Disney.
Well, now, he did actually do a couple of Disneys after that, but basically they were done with him. He also developed a drug and alcohol problem, marijuana. He was arrested for marijuana. And he made some B-movies after that, but he credits Christianity with getting him back on track. By the way, the Metropolitan Community Church became his church, the gay church, the LGBTQ church. He ended up running a carpet and upholstery company. Disney brought him back as a Disney legend in 2006. All is forgiven. But
he seemed to forgive them, which was interesting. They wanted to ignore the fact that they had mistreated him, but he seemed okay with that.
Well, he said, look, he said some of the directors of his films came after him, hit on him when he was 14.
I'm sure they did.
You know, he could have brought a lawsuit about that. He came out as a gay man in 1973.
And from a very different world, Marcia Friedman, 83, died in South Berkeley, California. But she is known for having been the first U.S.-born woman to be a member of the Israeli Knesset. And the one and only lesbian to ever be a member of the Knesset, or out lesbian. She was a very radical feminist leader. She introduced an abortion law in Israel, for which a gynecologist threw a pitcher of water at her. And by that, I mean the entire pitcher, not just the water. She opened a shelter for battered women. She spoke out in favor of Palestinian autonomy. This is a more recent picture of her, died at 83. She was a pistol.
She was a pink diaper baby from Newark, New Jersey. She had radical parents. She was back in the USA in the Bay Area. She was the founding president of the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace in 2002. So a totally radical life and a life well lived.
And also a life well lived in North Carolina, trans activist Janice Covington Allison died at 74. She'd been ill for a while. I think she died of some kidney failure complications. She was very involved in state politics in North Carolina as a trans activist. She was when the Democratic National Convention was held in Charlotte in 2012, she was an out trans delegate from North Carolina. She pushed diversity. She was the chair for diversity and outreach for the Democratic Party, a real leader in North Carolina.
Absolutely. And then we lost yet another black trans woman to murder, Keir LaPree Cartier, 21 years old, found fatally shot in her own car with the engine running. She was the 38th such murder this year. Since they say they don't think gender identity was the motive, but we've consigned these women to the margins, and they often meet violent ends.
Again, a theme we're seeing, particularly in the last couple of years, very well loved by family and friends. It used to be very difficult to get anyone to talk about these women after they were murdered because they had been rejected by family and friends. But lately, I think the theme is much more that they are part of a community, that they are part of a loving family and friend group. As you say, 38 that we know of this year, it's always an undercount, but 76% of those who have been murdered are black, and 66% under 30.
Well,
21 years old this woman was.
I was going to save this for internationalists, but it was nice to see that the White House did have an international meeting out of the White House of the State Department on transgender safety and issues. I think a lot of other countries are doing more. They're setting aside jobs. They're, you know, doing affirmative action. We're not doing that kind of stuff for our trans citizens.
No. And meanwhile, there was a shocking story in today, Wednesday's New York Times, about what the Indian Health Service has been doing. It turns out that there were reports of a pediatrician who worked for the Indian Health Service molesting thousands of Native young boys ages 10 to 13 over the years. And the Health Service commissioned a report on this under the Trump administration and then buried the report and didn't publish it. And now the report has been published because of a Freedom of Information lawsuit by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And the story is just horrifying. The pediatrician is a guy named Weber, who is currently serving multiple life sentences in prison after federal investigations in South Dakota and Montana. But this is a far greater report of his crimes and of the crimes of the Indian Health Service in ignoring complaints about this and covering up this final report. Just shocking, shocking.
Right. This was the week we learned that French priests had molested 300,000 cases, I think, going back. Anyway, the Human Rights Campaign is calling on the NCAA not to hold its Final Four basketball tournament in a state with laws discriminating against trans youth in sports.
Well, meanwhile, the WNBA playoffs are taking place, and 25% of the players, and I think they're taking place in Florida. I should double check.
Well, half the players of the Connecticut Sun are out.
Well, 25% of the players overall in the WNBA playoffs are out, and yes, 50% of the Sun, including their male coach, and they are the top-seeded team.
But the Dallas Wings have no out players. What's going on down there?
Well, that out may be the operative word. Meanwhile, in the continuing story of Carl Nassib on the Las Vegas Raiders, our favorite only out NFL player, he gave an interview this week where he talked about his life story and dropped the little tidbit that he has a boyfriend.
Ooh,
he has not told us who that boyfriend is, but
congratulations.
He's very happy about it. Not so happy the Raiders finally lost a game this week, so now they're 3-1. That's still great, but we'll see how far they get.
The National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association is urging the New York Times to revise its archives to reflect the new names of writers who have transitioned, transgender folks. They say that using their dead names exposes these people to harassment and harm. The News Guild wants the change, but the Times management says no.
Well, one thing I think is that these writers should demand that personally themselves. I think it would be harder for the Times to reject it if the writers themselves demanded it, but it shouldn't also be a burden on them.
Update on the January 6th coup attempt. Brandon, what's it, Strachey? The gay hairdresser who told hundreds of thousands of his followers to storm the Capitol to start a revolution, is pleading guilty. He faces 6 months. He was part of the Walk Away camp movement to get LGBTQ people out of the Democratic Party.
And good news from Louisiana, where the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has let stand a Louisiana lower court ruling outlawing the state writing sex offender on people's driver's license.
In big orange letters.
Unbelievable. But they're not supposed to do that anymore. Now, that includes people who have been entrapped by police officers. They're on the sex offender list and all sorts of others. It seems a little punitive of the state. And a nice little marriage story from Washington, D.C. back to the, wait a minute, the Washington Spirit soccer teams. Joanna Lohman has married Melody George, who is a senior manager with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The soccer player is on the right. Joanna, congratulations to them.
Okay. International news?
Wait a minute. Or maybe this, you have this under, yeah, okay, international news.
Well, we've told you they're making a lot of arrests in the murder of lesbian journalist Lyra McKee, who was killed in 2019 covering a riot by the new IRA there. Four more new arrests on top of the, that makes a total of six arrested and charged under the Terrorism Act for her murder.
In Taiwan, a court says a trans woman can change her gender on her government ID without proof of surgery, but we need a new law to be passed for that to apply to everybody.
Okay. At the United Nations, 50 countries have appealed to the UN Human Rights Council to protect and investigate abuses targeting intersex individuals. That's up from 37 last year. Among those signing are Albania, Namibia, Brazil, the UK, and the US. So that's progress.
Not so progressive. In Turkey, the Ankara Bar Association leader and 10 members of the executive board are now subject to being jailed for having made a public statement criticizing the homophobia of the top imam in Turkey and also his anti-HIV statements. It is said that they have insulted him by criticizing him, and they're going to be on trial starting November 11th for this.
I guess they don't know. They don't have a First Amendment. In British Columbia, the court ruled that deliberately misgendering an employee is a human rights violation. Now, we've had court decisions here saying it is free speech to misgender people and be rude to them.
Canada seems to have some stricter laws about speech.
By the way, the Vatican cleared that priest who was as a Vatican altar boy, was accused of sexually abusing other altar boys, Gabriel Martinelli. We covered the story. He's now 29. He was found to have corrupted a minor, but the statute of limitations is up on that. No higher-ups were found guilty for covering this thing up. He has not been defrocked yet.
All right. In AIDS news, unless you have more international news, there's been a conundrum in New York City for decades about a building in the West Village, basically across the street from the Stonewall Bar or down the block. This triangular building known as the Northern Dispensary, which was a health clinic.
Since 1831.
But it's been empty for 30 years because the owner died and his heirs held on to it and said, no, it can't be operated as anything but a health clinic.
Well, there's a deed restriction, and Housing Works tried to get in on this, serving the poor and all that, but they were not allowed to use it as housing for those folks.
But so now God's Love We Deliver is being allowed to rent the building for a few years anyway. I guess they'll see how it works out.
4 years. They once treated Edgar Allan Poe for a cold.
Not God's Love We Deliver, but the dispensary. Actually, the dispensary was a dental clinic until 1989 when it was shut down for refusing to serve people with AIDS.
Right there in the Village.
32 years ago. But okay. Now God's Love We Deliver, which is clearly a nicer agency than Housing Works, they're not going to house drug addicts, is going to use it for its offices while it continues to make and serve and deliver meals from its Soho location.
Our friends and supporters at Broadway Cares had their flea market this weekend, and they raised, and Broadway, you know, and Theater District, they raised $753,000 for the AIDS and health charities that they support. They fund projects in all 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the District of Columbia.
Chief of staff to City Council President Cory Johnson, Eric Botcher running
Council
for
Speaker.
Thank you. Eric Botcher now running to take over that seat as the member of the city council.
He doesn't have an opponent on the ballot.
Well, he beat several in the primary.
Yes, he did.
But he has announced he has COVID. Now, he is fully vaccinated. He's expected to remain healthy. But our best to Eric. And thank you for announcing that, Eric, and reminding us that we are all still vulnerable to the virus, even though fully vaccinated.
And if you're watching and you need anything, we're just around the corner.
Literally. We also, another hero we've lost this week, Bill Arnold at 83, founded the National ADAP Working Group, that's the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, and the Community AIDS National Network. All of that was about making sure that people of any income range had access to HIV drugs. A crucial part of the fight against the epidemic.
It's now a $1.3 billion program. And whenever states would say they're running out of money, he would get foundation money to fill in and do things. I mean, just save thousands of lives. He's survived by his partner, Michael. I think he was about 83.
And he was also well known for making people get together and talk. Activists, the pharmaceutical industry, government officials, he wanted to get things done. And so he worked very hard to make sure that all these different constituencies talk to each other.
Okay. Entertainment news?
Yes.
So the Funny Girl revival in the spring now is casting Jane Lynch as Mrs. Rosie Bryce in the Fanny Bryce Show. Has a new book by Harvey Fierstein. And Harvey Fierstein has a new book. Should we have him on?
Who?
Harvey Fierstein.
Yes. Sure. JoJo Siwa and Jenna remain at the top of the pack on Dancing with the Stars. They did a tango this week to, it was Britney Spears week on Dancing with the Stars. They did a fabulous tango to Hit Me Baby One More Time. We're going to include the video of that, a link to it in our show note. They got a little criticism from the judges for doing something, a tango that was a little too staccato, which one of the judges says was not Argentine friendly. But I was watching a Pedro Almodovar movie the other day, Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, and there was a tango in that that was very staccato. So I have to argue with the judges, but it's very sexy. And JoJo is now taking the lead in these dances and is just really strong and sexual. I highly recommend this.
They got straight eights out of 10. Yeah. Now, fresh from his Tony win, Matthew Lopez, who did The Inheritance, is making his directorial debut for Amazon with a romantic comedy, Red, White, and Royal Blue, adapted from Casey McQuiston's best-selling novel about the Latine, and Latine is the word that Matthew Lopez uses, son of the president and his relationship with Prince Henry, the grandson of the Queen of England. The first son has some kind of feud with Henry that strains U.S. relations, so they try to make peace between them, and romance blossoms, threatening the first mother's re-election campaign for president.
Please. And Netflix is getting on the gay Christmas movie bandwagon. They've got one coming out in December that includes Jennifer Coolidge as one of the moms. It's cool. I can't wait for that. But here's some real life news from... You sitting down?
I am.
The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City.
Yes.
Ready? All right. Well, first of all, there's a continuing storyline about the very fragile gay son of one of the women on the show who's being a little bullied by another one of the women. And his mom sticks up for him and says, he hasn't talked about his sexual orientation yet. Well, you know, there couldn't be a gayer boy on TV. So enough about that. But meanwhile, one of the events this last weekend was a fundraising party for a center in Utah and with branches around the country for trans kids, because there is a couple on the show that has a trans kid. So all the housewives go to this party, and they're all supporting this couple and their trans kid. And one of the guests at the party announces suddenly that he's making a donation to the center of $1 million to support trans kids in Utah. And then I looked up the center, and it turns out that it is being supported also by Tim Cook, Dan Reynolds of Imagine Dragons, and billionaire businessman Ryan Smith, who together have given $4 million to this
center. We could use a little of that support here in New York for new alternatives for homeless LGBTQ youth.
Well, they're building new centers around the country for trans kids. It's just supporting trans kids, particularly in Mormon communities. It was just mind-blowing. Meanwhile, this was a casino party, and as one of the housewives pointed out, we're drinking, we're gambling, we're two blocks from BYU. It was pretty hilarious.
All right. In Netflix news, Coleman Domingo, who's been a guest on the show, great actor, is going to star as Bayard Rustin in the Netflix film on him called Higher Ground, produced by the Obamas. Chris Rock as Roy Wilkins of the NAACP. Glenn Turman as A. Philip Randolph. Audra McDonald as Ella Baker. It's got a script by Dustin Lance Black and directed by George C. Wolfe. It is gay, gay, gay.
Now, I know that even you caught a glimpse last year of the HBO series We're Here with the drag queens from RuPaul's Drag Race going to small towns around the country. Season 2 is going to show up this coming Monday on HBO. Bob the Drag Queen, Eureka, and Shangela will be visiting Del Rio, Texas, Selma, Alabama, and Spartanburg, South Carolina. HBO, We're Here.
I don't think I'm going to London anytime soon, but if you are over there, Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart opened at the National Theatre's Olivier, starring the great Ben Daniels, to mostly very positive 4-star reviews.
A viewer pointed out the correction I need to announce. Lois Smith was not in The Great Gatsby. That was Lois Childs. But Lois Smith was in East of Eden, as we said last week.
Our late friend and colleague Colin Robinson would have been 60 on October 8th, and the Leslie Lohman Museum of Art is going to celebrate a book that includes a chapter about him. Called Nature's Wild. He's called the godfather of LGBTQI Caribbean communities. 7 p.m. October 8th, 26 Worcester Street.
Colin was wonderful. And the movie Surviving the Silence about lesbians in the military is going to air on Amazon and Apple Plus starting October 19th.
And thank you to our viewer, Bill, who explained the whole Latine evolution in language.
And that's it for us. We will see you next week.